This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, historic expansion of the NATO alliance as Turkey drops objections to Sweden and Finland applications. Key takeaways from the NATO summit in Madrid and the G7 summit in Germany. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. What a difference 12 years makes. At the 2010 Lisbon summit, NATO's strategic concept said, quote, NATO poses no threat to Russia. On the contrary, we want to see a true strategic partnership between NATO and Russia, closed quote. Well, one part of that phrase remains true to this day. NATO poses no threat to Russia. However, Russia's unprovoked invasion of Ukraine in late February has changed NATO's perception of Russia, which is that Russia poses one of the biggest security risks for the alliance. So much so that previously neutral Finland and Sweden applied for NATO membership. Both countries, one of which, Finland, shares a 1,340-kilometer-long border with the Russian Federation, are now on the road to membership, given the threat posed by Moscow. This after Turkey agreed to drop its initial objections to their accession in exchange for security guarantees related to alleged Kurdish terrorists. Washington also indicated it would sell U.S. F-16 fighter jets to Ankara. Reuters news agency reports that Putin said that Russia would respond in kind if NATO deployed troops and infrastructure in Finland and Sweden after they joined the U.S.-led military alliance. Meantime, U.S. President Joe Biden said in Madrid, quote, together with our allies, we're going to make sure that NATO is ready to meet threats from all directions across every domain, land, air, and the sea, unquote. In that vein, he pledged new deployments in Europe to include a permanent headquarters for the U.S. 5th Army Corps in Poland, enhanced rotational deployments to Romania and the Baltic states, and additional F-35 squadrons to the U.K. Separately, according to the VOA News Center, NATO is planning a sevenfold increase in its rapid response force to 300,000 troops. In addition to declaring Russia as a primary threat, NATO added China due to its coercive activities around the world, including its use of forced labor, intellectual property theft, and unfair trade practices. NATO's strategic concept mentions, quote, systemic challenges posed by the People's Republic of China and its deepening strategic partnership with Russia. Chinese leader Xi Jinping supports Moscow over its sovereignty and security issues, according to Stacey Goddard, a political scientist at Wesley College, who spoke with VOA. Beijing continues to buy substantial amounts of Russian oil, gas, and coal. Well, for more on the results of the NATO and G7 summits, we turn to two distinguished analysts. Jeffrey Rathke is president of the American Institute for Contemporary German Studies at the Johns Hopkins University here in Washington. Prior to joining AICGS, Jeff was a senior fellow and deputy director of the Europe program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, where his work focused on transatlantic relations and U.S. security and defense policy. Jeff also had a 24-year career as a Foreign Service officer. And Pierre Morcos. He is a visiting fellow in the Europe, Russia, and Eurasia program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, where he focuses on European security issues. A career diplomat with the French Foreign Service, Pierre most recently served as deputy head of the Strategic Affairs and Cybersecurity Division, focusing on NATO and European defense issues. And both gentlemen join me via Microsoft Teams. Welcome to the program.
Great to be with you, Carol.
Thank you for having me, Carol.
Jeffrey, let me begin with you. Let's get a readout from you on this historic summit surmounting Turkey's opposition to Sweden and Finland's accession. We saw boosting support for Ukraine now that it's in its fifth month of defending itself from Russian aggression. And then Jens Stoltenberg, of course, said that he sees this particular moment as the most serious security crisis since World War II. How would you characterize the achievements of this summit, Jeffrey Rathke?
Well, Carol, I think the most important thing is not any individual decision that has come from the NATO summit, but the overwhelming sense of unity and shared purpose that all of the NATO heads of state, heads of government have demonstrated. This meeting, of course, has come just after the meeting of the G7 leaders in Germany and a summit meeting of the European Union heads of government and heads of state the week before. So we've had over the last 10 days or so, one after another meeting of major leaders who have in different ways underscored their opposition to Russia's invasion of Ukraine and Russia's attempt to overturn the post-Cold War, and in some ways, the post-World War II order in Europe. In the case of the European Union, and we may get into that a bit more, the instruments that European leaders are using are a bit different than those that we've seen in the NATO context. But one after another, international organizations of the developed democracies have been saying that they will do whatever it takes for as long as necessary to support Ukraine. And I think that is the main message, although it's certainly interesting to get into some of the particular decisions that were made by NATO in this summit.
So turning to you, Pierre Morcos, for your take, and as a French diplomat, I certainly would like you to opine or comment upon the French position, because we do note that previously French President Emmanuel Macron had said that it would be best not to humiliate Russia. So if you could unpack that and reconcile that with what we saw, this extraordinary unity and solidarity coming out of the NATO summit.
Yes, sure. No, I fully agree with Jeff. I think the main message of these two summits was this clear demonstration of unity and resolve. And it has been very clear from all NATO and G7 leaders that they will continue to assist Ukraine and pressure Russia as long as it takes. And when it comes to France, President Macron has also quite a clear position on that. He clearly said that Russia must not and cannot win, that France will accelerate its support to Ukraine, including through military weapons, lethal weapons. France notably will deliver long-range artillery to Ukraine, but also armored vehicles. So clearly this is a good signal, a strong signal from France that Paris is clearly supporting Ukraine and not willing to pressure Kiev to surrender territories. And President Macron has also said clearly that it is up to Ukraine to decide the timing and the contours of a potential negotiation with Russia. But it is clear from a French perspective that we are not there yet. It is clearly too soon to speak about a negotiation with Moscow. The priority now is to keep assisting Ukraine, keep pressuring Russia until we have the necessary conditions for such discussion with Moscow.
Thank you for that, Pierre. And back to you, Jeff Rathke. Let's now talk about some of the very specific agreements that were made at the summit. Talk about what you think is really most notable, seeing a creation of a headquarters, a Fifth Army Corps in Poland. How extraordinary is that? In addition to the other elements, rotational brigade to Romania and enhanced deployments in the Baltics.
Well, I think that what we see is, in a way, NATO going back to basics. This is a refocusing of NATO on the core mission of territorial defense, of collective defense of Europe. And so over the last, you started off by referring to the 2010 strategic concept, which was agreed at a summit in Lisbon. As it so happens, I was working as an advisor to the NATO Secretary General at the time, and I remember that very well. And it's not just the way NATO characterizes Russia that has changed. It's also the way NATO defines its mission. I think if you look at the strategic concept, which was just approved at the summit in Madrid, it makes clear that the key purpose of NATO is collective defense. In the past, NATO's mission was a bit more evenly spread over not just the collective defense, but also the crisis management task, in other words, dealing with sort of regional conflicts, and also what they call cooperative security. In other words, establishing partnerships with countries that may have an aspiration to join NATO or that may just want a closer relationship in order to cooperate in other spheres. But all of that now takes a backseat to the task of the defense of the Euro-Atlantic area. And I think that's where the decision of Sweden and Finland to pursue NATO membership also is significant. Of course, there was a lot of drama that surrounded the position of Turkey opposing the application. That seems to have been dealt with now. But what this really means is that Sweden and Finland kind of complete the puzzle when you look at Northern Europe, indeed at the Arctic, and especially at the ways NATO would have to defend its NATO allies in the Baltic countries, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania. That becomes still a challenge because those are small countries with relatively small armed forces that are direct on the Russian border. But nevertheless, when you have the strategic depth that comes with Finland and Sweden joining the alliance and their pretty considerable military capabilities, that makes the security situation in Northeast Europe much more manageable from a NATO perspective, I would say.
Turning to you, Pierre Morcos, how ironic that Russia thought that it would weaken and divide NATO by invading Ukraine. And it seems to have done the opposite. We are now seeing an expansion, historic expansion with Finland and Sweden. And I'd like to get then your take on the specific outcome insofar as Jeffrey said, the alliance is going back to basics, territorial defense, looking at how Northern Europe and the Arctic are being reinforced with the expansion. What else would you like to add to that?
Well, I think also I fully agree with Jeff on the historic decision made by NATO leaders in significantly increasing their military posture. And we are shifting from a deterrence by reinforcement to a deterrence by denial, which means that NATO will significantly increase the size and scope of the troops deployed on the front nine states to deny any potential aggression from Russia. But they will also increase quite consequentially their reinforcement forces to be deployed on short notice in the event of a crisis or a war. So clearly this is a major shift and it will take some years to be fully completed. And I think another historic change and decision made in the summit was the mention of China in the strategic concept. As you said, China was not mentioned 12 years ago, and now it is described as posing systemic challenges to the alliance. And I think this is a recognition by NATO that China and its rise poses challenges, including in the Euro-Atlantic area. When you think about Chinese cyber operations, disinformation campaigns, but also growing strategic partnership with Russia, it is clear that China is posing challenges to the alliance, and NATO leaders agreed to increase their resilience to resist to these tactics and coercive policies. And one other interesting development has been the first participation of Indo-Pacific partners to the NATO summit, namely Australia, New Zealand, Japan, and South Korea. And I think that was a clear demonstration that the Indo-Pacific and the Euro-Atlantic area are deeply interconnected. And a crisis in one theater can have deep impacts on another one. And I think that the summit was a good example of these growing interconnections between the Indo-Pacific and Europe.
Thank you for adding that angle about the Indo-Pacific, Japan, South Korea, Australia, New Zealand having participated. We are going to take a short break. We'll be right back. You are listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Jeffrey Rathke, president of the American Institute for Contemporary German Studies at the Johns Hopkins University here in Washington, and Pierre Morcos. He's a French diplomat who is currently senior fellow in the Europe, Russia, and Eurasia program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. We are discussing the significant outcomes of the NATO summit in Madrid as member states solidify their support for Ukraine as Kyiv defends itself from Russian aggression. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on most of your favorite podcast apps. You may listen on the website also at voaafrica.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter at @Carol_Castiel or connect with us on Facebook at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Well, here's a shout out to a very loyal listener, Unikrishnan from Kerala, India. He tweets at Sting of Scorpio. Thank you for your recent feedback, and I hope you found our shows online. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our program. So back to you, Jeff Rathke, to continue our discussion. Perhaps we should go straight to the China-Russia strategic partnership and how much of a danger now NATO sees that and what it plans to do in order to combat this growing alliance.
Well, I agree. You know, Pierre pointed out that this was an important element in the decisions NATO leaders made. I think the characterization of China as a challenge to NATO's interests, to NATO's security, and to NATO's values gives a sense that this is not purely a military challenge NATO is looking at. And I think when you consider the geographic distance between China and Europe, naturally the ways that NATO deals with the growing challenges from China will be quite different from the way it approaches Russia, to say nothing of the fact that it's Russia that has unleashed an aggressive war of conquest in Ukraine, something that you might fear from China in the future, but it's not happening right now. So it's a much more open-ended recognition of China as a combination of threat, challenge, and competitor, but without specifying particular ways in which NATO is going to be operationally active. I think from an American point of view, there's always the question as well, you know, there are some countries, some European countries, some NATO allies that are quite active in the Indo-Pacific, France and the United Kingdom being first among them. But if you think about this from a Washington point of view, you probably don't want to deplete Europe's military resources by trying to focus on China and Russia at the same time. It makes a whole lot more sense for most European countries to strengthen their contributions to security in Europe. And then where appropriate, and especially with those countries that have capabilities and a history of activity in the Indo-Pacific, to coordinate how you can deal best with the emerging challenges that China represents, whether it's with regard to Taiwan, with regard to the Chinese attempt to assert control over the South China Sea, or other similar kinds of issues.
So back to you, Pierre Marcos. We are seeing this growing coordination on security matters and efforts to shape a global order more favorable to autocrats and their interests, so Russia and China. What about those who say by expanding and tightening solidarity, NATO, in a sense, is throwing Russia into China's arms? I mean, how do you reconcile that?
Well, I think that the summit was a clear demonstration that NATO is a political alliance with shared democratic values. And clearly, the strategic concept clearly explains that these values are a competitive advantage compared to autocratic regimes like Russia and China. But to answer your question, I don't think that NATO is, in a way, strengthening the rapprochement between Russia and China. NATO is not trying to be in a position of a new Cold War with China. It explains that it poses systemic challenges, but it also explains that it is open to a constructive engagement with China. So clearly NATO has a multi-layered approach to China, similar to the one defended by the United States or Europe. For NATO, China is indeed a challenge, but it is also a competitor and for some issues, a partner in which NATO can have discussions. And I think this is important to have this more complex picture and not to try to create two camps with NATO on one hand and Russia and China on the other hand.
Thank you for that excellent explanation. Back to you, Jeffrey Rathke. With regard to Ukraine, beleaguered Ukraine in its fifth month of trying to defend itself, albeit with quite a number of arms and weapons coming from the West, they're constantly asking for more. What is the situation with regard to Ukraine's membership in the EU? How important is that in the long run? And how do you see in the coming weeks and months this battle between Ukraine and Russia playing out? And to what extent, you know, Ukraine is on the road to some sort of a victory or prevailing with the help of NATO and the EU?
Well, there's a lot there. First of all, I think, as you pointed out at the start of your question, the Ukrainian relationship with the EU is extremely important. And the EU summit that met before the G7 and NATO summits, one of their significant decisions was to grant Ukraine candidate status in the EU. Now, that does not mean immediate Ukrainian membership, no, not by any stretch of the imagination. Joining the EU is a long, formalized process that requires lots of adjustments by a prospective member, and especially one like Ukraine, which is a country of 40 million people. So it would, if it joined the EU, it would immediately be one of the larger members of the EU. So I think that, though, is a signal that European leaders want not just to have a partnership with the EU, but they see Ukraine as a member of that union in the medium to longer term. And so that is a great encouragement, I think, to Ukraine. You know, depending on some of the other ideas that are out there, there may be other ways in the shorter term to involve Ukraine in dialogue and even in programs with the European Union. There is, I think, just a few days ago, a decision about transportation cooperation, for example, which would make it more possible for Ukrainian vehicles, let's say trucks, transport vehicles, to operate in the EU without requiring additional licensing. It's all very technical. But the point is, this provides a new way for Ukraine to interact, sometimes at a high level, with European counterparts and for them to support Ukraine in its aspirations to become part of the EU. I think there's also the question you ask about the course of the war. Ukraine is getting more advanced weaponry as the war drags on longer. Pierre mentioned the French artillery. Also, Germany is providing some of its most advanced artillery, and the Netherlands as well, to Ukraine. That's in addition to the system that the United States has been providing, including multiple launch rocket systems, which have dramatic increase of the range over systems that Ukraine has had. So all of these things show Ukraine being able to modernize its military hardware even while the conflict is going on. Now, what is much harder to predict is whether that will be sufficient to tip the balance in Ukraine's favor. The Russians have, on the one hand, lost a lot of their hardware during this war, but nevertheless, when it comes to raining down dumb bombs and non-precision guided missiles and artillery on Ukrainian territory, the Russians can do that for a long time to come. So it's a question of whether Ukraine can turn these technical advances into gains on the battlefield that would force Russia to withdraw further and in some way acknowledge defeat. That's the real hard part of this. It is going to take a long time. You said we're in the fifth month of this conflict. And unfortunately, there's no sign right now of Russia being ready to enter into any negotiations. Zelensky on the Ukrainian side has said he is willing to talk, but the Russian demands are so far out of any acceptable range that it's not really a possibility at this point.
Turning to you, Pierre Marcos, for the last word on the so-called the longer-term strategy and the shorter-term strategy, the longer-term looking at Ukraine membership in the European Union, the longer-term meaning how long it will take for incredible sanctions against Russia to really bite the economy, the oil embargo, of course, NATO expansion. All of that is excellent, and many say that NATO's strength and all of these longer-term strategies are certainly, you know, weakening the economy and so forth, but we still have a short-term and Ukraine, you know, battling on a day-to-day basis against indiscriminate strikes, whether on the Mall in Ukraine and so many civilian casualties. What are your thoughts regarding how the longer-term and the shorter-term strategy will together, you know, eventually give Ukraine the upper hand, the Western upper hand, or will Russia somehow lash out? What are your thoughts?
Well, as Jeff said, the war will still last many months, if not more. So it is essential to maintain the pressure against Russia and the assistance to Ukraine as long as it takes. And this resilience is essential, but it is not a given. Clearly, there is a fear of war fatigues in the public opinions in the United States and Europe, especially with sanctions having quite a damaging impact on the inflation on our economies. And also there is a fear that Europeans have not the necessary stockpiles to continue providing ammunition, fuel, and pieces of weaponry to Ukraine. So I think it is critical that both the US and the Europe cope with these risks of war fatigue and lack of ammunition and so on. So it means notably to limit the impact of the sanctions on our energy prices, which means that we should find other ways of providing fuel and fossil fuels. It means also to accelerate quite rapidly our production of weapons. It means also to come back to an economy of wartime, which is an expression which was used by President Macron, to clearly speed up our military production. And this is essential because, as I said, we are there for the long term. So we need to strengthen our resilience to support Ukraine as long as possible.
Well, gentlemen, I can't thank you enough for your terrific insights on this topic, and we shall continue following it and asking for your comments in the weeks ahead. But for now, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I would like to again thank my terrific guest, Jeffrey Rathke, president of the American Institute for Contemporary German Studies at the Johns Hopkins University, and Pierre Marcos, senior fellow in Europe, Russia, and Eurasia program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.